This is The End User, episode 191 for Thursday, February 5th. A Pono pleases a picky parakeet. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr. Chris, I think it's been a good week for futurism, for the internet, for net neutrality, and for the end user, since we've been ranting about net neutrality for, it's been years now.
Yeah, it has been a really long time, and we're really getting our first look at if the FCC is going to do anything, exactly what they're going to do.
So what is our first look? What happened?
So it's kind of weird. So the chairman of the FCC is now Tom Wheeler, and I know a lot of people had some misgivings because he used to be some kind of cable executive. Now, he also, in this piece that he's written, says that he was a he was involved with a startup of some kind that was dealing with the internet, and in fact, that startup went out of business. So that's kind of an interesting perspective. I don't think I heard anyone say that previously. They always brought up his connections with the cable industry. So anyway, he wrote a piece in Wired, of all places, which is, it's kind of weird to have the chairman of the FCC write an op-ed for Wired, don't you think?
It's a little unusual. Yeah, I definitely thought so, but I think he's trying to make a bold statement.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think Wired is the correct place to go if you're wanting to reach out to the people. You know, some little press announcement of some kind from the FCC would get some attention, but I feel like him authoring a piece in Wired is kind of weird and cool. And
right.
Maybe he's trying to show that he's, you know, into the internet world in a way that otherwise people might not believe.
He could have gone to the New York Times or the Washington Post with this story.
Yeah.
I presume. I don't know if they made those offers or if it was something that was considered. But he went to Wired, and what that says is, like, he's trying to address the people who care about this issue and be like, look, I know what you think. You know, I've come up with a plan. I think you're going to like it.
So what he's saying here is that it is his intention to pursue classifying broadband providers here in the U.S. as Title II. And what that means is that they will be known as common utilities. So basically what that means is that puts them under the same umbrella that all of the telecommunication companies are under. And so a lot of the laws that applied to the phones in the past with AT&T and so on will also apply to both wireline and wireless internet, is his intention at least. So he's saying that he's going to put this proposal out in front of Congress and, you know, kind of see what people think. And, you know, it's kind of subject to change. And we didn't really get any details beyond that pale, right? It's just him stating his intention as to what he's going to do. Now, that said, I am kind of surprised that they were going to go with that. You know, in the past, we've talked about this, and we've basically got three things that could happen, and that is to let it continue to be regulated as it is right now. And what was that? Section 706, I believe. That,
right.
That was the first option. And the second option was Title II, which is hugely more restricting, and it really is the government placing a lot of restrictions on what the companies in what the broadband providers can and cannot do. And the third option was to do nothing. So his intention to use Title II is interesting because they're going to have to. Oh, and sorry, there was a fourth option that slipped my mind. That would be to get Congress to introduce a new something that would regulate it in a way that makes sense for the internet. And I've always thought that that is the best thing that you could possibly do. But I think that going with Title II is a nice compromise between both of those things. So, but you're going to have to take Title II and kind of carve it up and have it make sense. You know, there's a lot of stuff in Title II that just doesn't make sense for the internet. So they're going to have to do something to it to make it make sense in the world of broadband providers.
Right, but Mr. Wheeler did a pretty good job of explaining the broad strokes of what he was proposing and putting it in the historical context to understand why they were moving in that direction.
Right. Now, I think if there's something that we can all agree upon, it's that the internet providers here in the United States are not adequately serving the consumers in the markets that they're serving, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in fact, last week, the FCC, in another small victory for consumers, declared that in the United States, broadband should only count for connections faster than 25 megabits download and 3 megabits upload, which puts more than half the country outside of the reach of actual broadband connections.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see where this actually goes, but this is probably the first and potentially most difficult step is to say, okay, we've heard what the consumers have told us about. We see the market, and this is going to be our plan going forward, and we'll see how Congress reacts to that, and we'll see how people at Wired and people, the internet at large, kind of reacts to that. So this is the very first step into getting some kind of sanity back in the broadband game here in the U.S. So I think I've come around to Title II. I feel like I was, before I knew we needed something, I wasn't sure if it was Title II or not, but it really seems to me to be the best option that we could take at this point.
I agree with that, and I think it's kind of the only option that we can take that I like.
Well, again, the ideal would be to have Congress step in and do something, and do something new. And
that doesn't seem likely to me.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So that being so unlikely means that Title II is probably the best thing that we could possibly do. But I don't know. That's a political point of contention that others could disagree with. But just seeing the reaction to this at large, it seems to me that just about everybody I've seen who is a consumer is liking what Tom Wheeler is putting forth. And I'm imagining that if they do continue through with this, that Verizon and AT&T and Comcast and all the internet providers will probably sue and try to get them to back off on some of the language in this somehow. So we'll kind of see how it goes going forward.
Yes, we will. And we will continue to monitor and inform our listeners about it. But pretty good 2 weeks. Pretty good for net neutrality.
Yes. So one last thing that's a little bit unique about this is that he's talking about both wireless and wireline. And that's a kind of a reversal from what we've seen in the past. In the past, they've been completely hands-off in wireless because it was such a big growth area for the companies that were providing wireless. But they're saying that these rules are going to apply to wireless as well. So that's kind of a reversal.
Yeah. But good. I mean, the internet's the internet. Just because it's wireless doesn't mean that it gets to not be the internet.
Yeah, you're right. It's still the internet, and I feel like they've had their period of early rapid innovation and investment and that kind of thing, and now is probably the right time to step in and see if there is some kind of abusive behavior going on, because that's what'll be at some kind of debate here is whether or not you can leave them alone or not. And I think on both wireline and wireless, you can state with some certainty that you cannot leave them alone at this point in time.
I would agree with that for sure.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what's happening with Title II, and I think that's a pretty good jumping off point. So like you said, we'll, you know, when something happens in this realm, we'll, of course, report on it here on the podcast. So, Taylor, in our other bit of top news here this week, I'm wondering if you're switching your email app on your iPhone.
I'm not. I've tried several different email apps. But I'm generally pretty happy with the built-in mail app.
Yeah, and if that app serves your needs, and maybe it's a little bit simpler than some of the others, then why move to something else? Is that kind of the idea?
Well, it's just integrated, and I'm used to it. I have no problems with it.
Yeah, I could see that. So the news is that, which I guess you're not going to bite on, is that Microsoft has released Outlook for iOS. And The Verge is saying this is the best Gmail app on the iPhone, and it's made by Microsoft.
Well, I tried it, and I would agree that it's, well, at least when I tried the both of them, I liked the Outlook app better for Gmail than the Gmail app.
Right. Yeah, the Gmail app has always been kind of a second-class citizen, hasn't it?
I still like the Gmail app fine, but I like Apple Mail better.
Yeah, and I guess the contention is that the Gmail app is not as good on iOS as it is on Android. You'd kind of expect that, though.
I've never used the Gmail app on Android, so I'm not sure. But yeah, I would expect that it's better on Android, or maybe people just don't know any better because they don't have Outlook or Apple Mail.
Yeah, it could be. You know, I'm currently in the position where my custom domain email is at Outlook.com. So I've been using the Outlook app for Android, and I've been using the Gmail app for a couple other Gmail accounts that I've got. So, you know, I've gotten to use it a little bit, but my main email is still on the Outlook app, and that app is pretty decent.
It's good for Android too?
Yeah, the Outlook app for Android, it feels just like the Windows Phone Mail app did. So since I've recently switched from Windows Phone to Android, we talked about that on the last show, it feels quite comfortable for me. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about the Outlook app for the iPhone. It's got that same kind of interface where you on each so you pull up your inbox and on you get a list of messages, and on each message you can kind of swipe to the right to archive it, and you can swipe to the left to delete it. And I think that albeit an undiscoverable option for new users, it seems to be a pretty good way of doing things.
Yeah, it didn't help me very much in trying to set up my accounts in the Outlook app. But I guess in theory, it's nicer.
Yeah, I think I'd have to really go use it, and I don't have an iPhone around me, so I'd have to use it to really know what the user experience is like.
It's fine. I think it's a lot like the user experience in Windows Phone or Android. It's a little bit more iPhone-ish. It follows the general
The guidelines.
Interface guidelines, but it feels very modern.
Right. Okay. So there has been a little bit of concern about security in some way with this. Now, from what I've seen posted, it's mainly about corporate security. So there's two facets to this. One is that a security researcher did a little dance to kind of cut off the phone, and he figured out that there has to be a way for Microsoft to be storing the credentials because it will do some things on your behalf. So since Microsoft is doing something on your behalf, it means they must be storing the credentials somewhere. And as we know, in an age of the internet where things are quite likely to leak, probably lesser so from Microsoft. But if that database gets loose, then your credentials are potentially out there in the wild. So that's not too great. And of course, we also know, and we've talked about in the past, that there is a way to store your password without actually storing the credentials anywhere. But to access a third-party service like this, you really have to store the credentials in some way. So apparently Microsoft is in fact doing that. And particularly if you're in a corporate world, that may not fly with your company. So I've seen a lot of companies are trying to figure out how to block iPhone users from using this app.
Well, the other thing that enterprise corporate IT departments are worried about is that the new version of the Outlook app does not support centralized mobile device management.
Right. So it supports, and we got a little confused in the pre-show about this, but it supports Exchange Mail, but it doesn't support any of the management capabilities that also come with Exchange Server. So the ability for a corporate entity to wipe your phone remotely so that their corporate data doesn't leak out, that is out the window with this app. So it will work with mail, but you're not going to get all of the kind of device management stuff that you get with the rest of Exchange Server. So
yeah, and but The iPhone and Android phones both have ways to do that natively if you
Yeah,
use a different
true.
mail app.
Yeah, true. And I think now I haven't done this, but I'm pretty sure on Android you can sign up to be managed by Exchange and then not receive the email. I'm pretty sure you can do that. I'm not 100%, but I'd imagine it would be the same on iPhone. So maybe you can get around that. I don't know.
Yeah, I've never tried signing up for a service and then turning them all off. I don't know how well that would work. Part of me wants to say it wouldn't, but I don't know either.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure the enterprise guys have thought about this, and if they haven't, then you should try it out. So the other bit is that they're worried about Dropbox integration, in that this app allows you to pull in, in, let's say, corporate email in that case, and then suck out all of the attachments into Dropbox and that kind of thing. And I just really don't see that as a thing that makes any sense at all. So you're worried about people extracting attachments from their email and putting it into their personal Dropbox account. Well, if you could access the email and download the attachment anyway, you could do that without the integration at all.
Yeah,
So
you can do that from a computer. I
Right.
haven't seen any IT departments that have been able to block that.
Yeah, I mean, you would have to block Dropbox. So that part seemed a little over the edge to me. Now, I understand being a little sensitive about storing credentials. I understand being a little upset that it doesn't tie into the device management services in any way. But I really just don't understand why anybody would have a problem with Dropbox integration. Because if you've already got email attachments in there, and maybe they're sensitive and they're corporate data, then they shouldn't be there in the first place. It has nothing to do with Dropbox integration. If that kind of sensitive information is in the inbox in the first place, you're already hosed. So I'm not sure it makes sense to punish anybody by not having Dropbox and Google Drive and OneDrive integration when there's really just no reason to that I can see.
I agree. It's actually kind of amazing that Outlook supports all of those third-party file sharing systems when they have OneDrive set up to work with them already. But it's nice that they want it to work with everything.
Yeah, Taylor, this is the new Microsoft. We've talked about this kind of in the past, where this is kind of Microsoft's new philosophy. They're kind of saying, look, we're a software company. We make software for places. We're not a platform company, in that we're artificially going to prop up Windows Phone anymore, and we're not artificially going to prop up Windows anymore by having services be by having services kind of lock you into those platforms. They're just saying, use whatever you think is best, and our software will be there.
Well, I did recently create a new Outlook.com email address. It was for someone else, but I helped set it up. And I noticed that it said, "Hey, we see you've got Gmail. Do you want to export all of your Gmail information into Outlook.com?" I said, "Oh, well, it's nice that you want me to know I have that option. But no, I would like to keep Gmail just as it is. Thank you."
And I went through some process like that, and at the time that I did it wasn't that easy. To port all my mail over, I had to give Outlook POP access and then let it download it for like 2 days and then go through all this rigmarole. But I guess they've cleaned that up, huh?
It would appear that they've cleaned it up, although I don't know if it applies to Google Apps for my domain.
Yeah, true, because I was moving from a custom Google Apps email to a custom Microsoft Outlook.com email. There may have been something about that combination that was a little different.
Perhaps. Well, the funny thing to me here is that Outlook, the iPhone app, is now a fantastic app for Gmail, and it's not so good for Microsoft Exchange accounts.
Yeah, at least in the corporate setting. I think for our audience, which I'm sure there are a lot of corporate people that listen, but we're trying to focus on the consumer as much as we can. And I think for the consumer, this is huge, because the consumer doesn't really care about all that stuff.
Well, there are plenty of consumers who use their corporate
Yeah, in the
email
corporate.
account as their primary mail.
Right. So I wonder if companies blocking the Outlook app would affect anyone.
Yeah, they might. But it is absolutely, there's no reason not to use this app for any privately managed account that you don't need an IT person to remotely access your phone.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the upshot, is that it's a good choice for consumers out there now.
Okay, so that's the top news for this week.
Well, so I wanted to get in one last little tidbit of top news, and that's that last 2 weeks ago when we were doing the podcast, we talked about the Spartan browser, and I had mentioned that it was a complete rewrite of the Internet Explorer rendering engine called Trident. And the article we were sharing, in fact, said that it was written on top of Trident. So I just wanted to mention that we've got a little more clarification now, and it looks like the rendering engine that is inside of the Spartan browser from Microsoft is actually a rewrite of Trident, but Trident will sit alongside it to act as a backwards compatibility layer. So we were a little confused about that in the last podcast, so I just wanted to clear that up.
I'm still a little confused. Why didn't they just rewrite it to be backwards compatible?
I guess they could have. It's like how in Internet Explorer 11, for example, you can open the developer tools and you can say, okay, emulate IE8 right now, and it'll load up IE8's rendering engine and pretend and masquerade to be IE8. So I assume they're going to have something similar, where if you need to use an application that's compatible with older Internet Explorer versions, then you can still have the Trident engine sitting alongside the new engine. And then eventually, once the world has moved on in 50 years or whatever, assuming we're still using browsers, then, you know, Trident will go away eventually.
Yikes. Well, I guess it's good that they have both then. I'm still not sure.
Yeah, if you don't need the backwards compatibility, then you won't use Trident. So if you just use Internet Explorer like a normal person would, if you were using Spartan rather as a normal person would, you would never even know the difference.
Okay, still don't get why it's there then.
Yeah, it's just for like in maybe a corporate environment where you have an application that only works on IE8 or something like that, it'll still allow you to go back into that mode. But for most people who are browsing most of the websites, you just wouldn't need it ever. That's all.
Right, so but everyone has it anyway.
Right, yeah, it's there in case you need it, and you probably won't ever.
Good, get rid of it.
So, I just wanted to clear that up, and I guess we'll move on into the afterburners.
All right. Is your seatbelt on? I'm ready to go.
Yeah, my seatbelt is securely fastened. I have my chest strap on, so I am stuck to the seat. Let's get running.
In Apple's quarterly earnings call, they revealed that the Apple Watch, previously announced to ship in early 2015, will be shipping in April 2015. And then Apple was forced to clarify what they thought early 2015 meant. And they answered, early 2015 is January to April. Mid 2015 is May to August. And late 2015 is September to December.
Yeah, so not quite what other people think is early 2015, but yeah, it's good that we have a month now that we're hoping that it will ship. So at least
and
we have more information
right
now.
Now we have a 30-day window instead of a window that we really weren't sure how long it was.
Right. So Verizon is launching some new prices for a lot of its data plans, starting off with a 500 megabyte plan for $20 for at least for the data portion of the plan. So what they've done is they've got plans from 500 megabytes up through 20 gigabytes, 20 gigabytes being 140 now. So they've shaved about $10 off nearly every tier that you could be on between 500 megabytes and 20 gigabytes. And so if you're a Verizon customer, you might see a little discount if you sign a new contract.
Okay, cool. The Amazon Echo voice recognition widget has gotten a software update that adds a couple of features, including increased response and speed of accuracy, more Wikipedia coverage, and new spelling and definitions of words, and more importantly, is adding voice control for Pandora, Spotify, and iTunes, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I think that's a really good option to have, to have integration with these services, because otherwise, you know, it would be really hard to figure out, you know, where exactly do you have to put the music to get it to integrate. So having all of those services in there, particularly Pandora, that's really cool that you can just say, hey, Echo, play this thing on Pandora and it'll play a station or whatever. That's really cool to see.
Well, I guess the way that it works is it communicates with iOS and Android devices to be able to pull that music through.
So that way they don't have to make a deal with Pandora or something like that.
Right.
So in other Amazon news, it looks like this one is kind of strange, Taylor. Amazon is opening its first staffed store, and that is inside of Purdue University. So I guess it's kind of a prototype of sorts for them, and they're going to see how it goes. But yeah, you can have Amazon packages delivered to this place. They've got staff there. They're going to do some kind of student deal on the students' books for Purdue, and it's kind of cool to see. It's the first time that Amazon has had a real store that has staff in it.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and there are already rumors starting to speculate that Apple may be interested in purchasing Radio Shack retail locations when they become available in the future. So maybe we're seeing the beginning of big changes at Amazon, or maybe they just are trying out doing college bookstores.
Yeah, I think they're just kind of dipping their toe in the water and see how it goes.
Clearly, otherwise they would have made a bigger deal out of this.
So in yet more Amazon news, they've released an application that's just a normal old Windows app, and it's called Kindle Convert. And what it is it's a way for you to turn, you know, paper books and, you know, drawings and that kind of thing into an ebook. So that seems like a pretty cool option to have if you know, not like every person is going to take, you know, their version of Dune and scan it in and then that's their ebook, but this is kind of a transferal application that some people might need for some reason. So it's a pretty cool thing to just kind of have on your radar if you ever need to scan some real life something into an ebook format. It's cool to note that this now exists, and it's called Kindle Convert.
And it's just for Microsoft Windows right now, although it can send things to your Kindle, clearly. Now, Microsoft, more interestingly, has developed a new Android app, and it's a screen replacement app called Picturesque Lock Screen. It adds some functions, shortcuts, and I think the point is beautiful images.
Yeah, it's basically part of it is it adds this the Bing picture of the day to your lock screen. That seems pretty cool. I have yet to flip this on and play around with it on my Android device, but I'll be doing that right after the show, so I'll check it out.
Yeah, not to mention the Bing search bar.
Right, because we all like Bing as a search engine, right, Taylor?
Oh, it's my fourth favorite.
Let's see. Google, Bing, DuckDuckGo. Okay.
So, Alta Vista is number one.
Oh, Alta Vista. What about Lycos?
No. Ask Jeeves is good, though. Jeeves makes a big comeback in the future.
Okay, well, you can ask Jeeves about the new mattress smart cover from Luna, and this seems pretty cool. So it's basically just a piece of cloth that you wrap around your mattress, and presumably it has to be powered in some way, and it uses if-this-then-that integration to do things depending on what's happening with the mattress. So, for example, if you like the Nest to turn down the temperature when you go to sleep, then the smart mattress can notice you getting into bed, and it can lower the temperature. It can also measure heart rate and a bunch of other stuff. So I'm not exactly sure, you know, what it would mean to have this kind of smart mattress cover, but I kind of like this idea of thinking outside the box, really. And that's in pre-order now. They're saying pre-orders are going to ship in August 2015. The smallest version, which is the only one available for pre-order, is $199. So all kinds of possibilities that could happen with a smart mattress. A bit weird, but cool to see.
It does seem a little bit weird at first, but, you know, there are all these smartphone sleep apps that require you to have your phone in bed with you to track your movements and metrics and things like that. And this seems to be just taking it a step further in a way that I think is really smart. There's, you know, why not have as many sensors in the bed as possible if they're not disrupting your sleep, which I think having your phone in bed is more disruptive than this.
Yeah, and, you know, things like Fitbit and a lot of the fitness tracker bands do this very thing where you can track your sleep in some way. So, yeah, why not just be able to build it into the mattress and do nothing instead of having to wear a fitness band and or fiddle around with the phone? It seems cool.
It does, absolutely. That seems pretty cool to me, too. So PC gaming company Razer has announced their new laptops, which have some pretty impressive specs. They've got a 14-inch chassis and prices starting at $2,200. So, Chris, what do you know about the Razer Blade?
So this is a really compelling looking laptop, and forget about gaming for just a second. Sure, okay, it can play games, but what that also means is it's just a really, really powerful laptop. So this is a Core i7 machine. It's 14 inches, got a huge 3200 by 1800 LED backlit. The screen is IGZO, which I remember you were had some kind of pick of the year for IGZO being a huge thing in 2015. It's got a 16 gigs of RAM. They've specifically designed the aluminum chassis to be a heatsink as well. It's got a green backlit keyboard. It's starting at $2,200, and it's 0.7 inches thick. So this is up there on the upper end of the spectrum for MacBook Pros, and it's pretty thin. This is kind of a ultrabook in the gaming space and slash just powerful laptop space that we really haven't seen before. So I think this is a particularly exciting device, albeit on the extreme upper end of the pricing. So it's really cool to see.
Yeah, you're right. There are a lot of my favorite technologies in here. I especially like when chassis double as heat sinks. That's one of my favorites. This is a very impressively spec'd laptop. Now, do you think people who aren't gamers are going to be tempted to plunk down more than $2,000 for this computer?
Yeah, I would imagine, you know, the professional kind of person, like a video editor or even an audio editor for recording music and that kind of thing, you know, stuff that takes a lot of horsepower. Sure, I don't see why not. I mean, they market this as a gaming platform, and they've got a hefty graphics card in there. But I could see developers getting in on this. I could see particularly video editors getting in on this. People who want to run Photoshop on this, I could see this being pretty cool. So I they're definitely not marketing like that. But I don't see why anybody who doesn't want a really thin, super high-end laptop wouldn't bite on this. It seems like a great option.
Sure, it's a great option, but I can think of one reason why that market wouldn't bite on this, and it's the MacBook Pro.
Yeah. And that's what I'm saying is this is of the upper end of the MacBook Pro spectrum, and it's not just a gaming laptop, although that's how they're marketing it.
Sure. Well, I think it's definitely a go-to for gamers, but its market outside of that is pretty limited.
Yeah. I'd actually agree with that. All right, so taking the exact opposite approach to some kind of new PC, we've got the new Raspberry Pi 2, which has a bunch of different kinds of upgrades, and this is this little credit card size computer. So you've got an entire computer built into something the size of a credit card with a couple ports on the end of it. So we've talked about it before, and this is a new quad core ARM Cortex A7 version. Now this is also launching at the $35 price range. And what's kind of cool about this also is that Microsoft has announced that you will be able to run Windows 10 on this little $35 Raspberry Pi. So typically in the past, these Raspberry Pis have run some kind of Linux distribution. And I guess Microsoft is wanting to get into this a little bit as well. So you get your pick of installing Linux to an SD card or Windows 10 onto presumably an SD card for it to run. So that's that was a cool device in the first generation, and it's good to see them up their game a little bit. This could be a pretty decent little, you know, embedded computer, maybe home theater PC or something like that for somebody. So
yeah, the support for Windows 10 is a major coup for the Raspberry Pi, and it's amazing that you can run almost anything you want on here. Chris, I have to wonder, which was the last version of Windows that ran on 900 megahertz?
Oh, it have to have been quite old. But the last version of Windows that ran on ARM was Windows RT and non-existent before that.
Right.
So I assume they've got some kind of Windows embedded kind of thing that they're gonna target devices like this with.
I guess they'll have to, yeah.
So I assume it's not going to be, it may be full Windows 10, and they may just call it Windows 10, but I bet you they've got some kind of stripped down version for it or something like that. So we don't really know. I'll have to, I'm hoping to get my hands on one of these things. You know, it's just $35, and I'd like to get it running and see what it looks like.
All right. Yeah, I would like to see that as well. But that'll do it for the afterburners. We can move on to the end user stories. I find it interesting that our next story, Chris, is called Windows RT is officially dead, just as we announce Windows 10 is coming to ARM.
Right, so Windows 10 is on the ARM Raspberry Pi, but Windows RT is dead. So this is from The Verge. The word officially is a little bit questionable, but the last device to run Windows RT currently in the market was the Nokia Lumia 2520 tablet, and that is no longer for sale. So if Microsoft's silence on the future or lack thereof of Windows RT is any indication, this is probably the last we're going to see of some kind of attempt of an embedded version for ARM for touch tablets.
Well, that makes a little bit more sense, I think. Microsoft clearly wasn't quite sure what the future of this was going to be. I think they realized it was probably too much development for not enough profit.
Yeah, and you know, I kind of wonder, we talked about the Raspberry Pi, and I wonder if they said, well, we did all that work to get Windows running on ARM, we might as well throw it onto the Raspberry Pi, or you know, these kind of these kind of maker devices where you know, with the they're trying to push into Internet of Things as well, and I wonder if they're just like, well, you know, it can run on ARM, so let's just kind of set it free over there, but we're not going to make any mainstream touch devices like they were going to.
Or maybe they're just branching the ARM division back into Windows 10.
Yeah, I'd love to see some kind of Frankenstein Raspberry Pi, you know, Surface device that has a touch screen and is, you know, you can like DIY a Surface RT out of the Raspberry Pi somehow.
Or DIY a Surface conference thing. What do they call it? The 84-inch TV?
The Surface Hub is what they
call it. The Surface Hub. Yeah. You can DIY one of those out of a Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, well, I don't think with those, there's some kind of special version of Windows. I don't know if it was an app that ran on top of Windows that you would run, but they had some customizations to put the Windows on the big screen like that. So I'm not sure you would get that
particular... Yeah, sounds perfect for DIY, Chris. Not sure what the problem is.
Well, I'm just not sure they'll release that.
Oh, no, they won't. It'll definitely be a hack job.
Yeah. So anyway, that's a little sad. My Surface RT wept a tear upon learning this news, and looks like they're just going to go forward with their Surface Pro line. Of course, we don't know that for sure, but with every day that goes by, it's increasingly more likely, and at some point we can call it 100%.
Somebody is going to write a version of Windows 10 for your Surface RT. I predict it now.
Now, it doesn't mean that people aren't going to put Windows on tablets. It just means that they're probably not going to be ARM-based tablets. And it's a little unclear because the smaller tablets, it was 8 inches and under, were able to use Windows 10 with Bing, I guess what they'll call the free version. And it's a little unclear if some of those tablets may be ARM-related or not, but this touchscreen-only without a desktop version of Windows it looks like it's going to be gone.
But we don't know. It's not official.
No, it's entirely not official, but it seems quite likely at this point.
It definitely seems likely we're not going to see anything like Windows RT anytime soon.
And we'll move on to the next story. I think what was really unlikely was that any human could tell the difference between a decent audio player and the totally overkill quality of the Pono player. So we've talked about the Pono player before. That's Neil Young's MP3 player that can play super duper high quality audio files. And in fact, they had their own store to distribute remastered super duper high quality audio files. And it really turns out, you know, people have got their hands on the Pono player for review, and David Pogue over at Yahoo Tech did a single blind test, and people actually preferred the phone's audio to the Pono player.
Wow, I guess that's not really that surprising, but man, for such an expensive,
yeah, it's $400,
highly precise, thoroughly accredited music player to get reviewed so poorly. I think about myself 10 years ago and how much I would have loved a $400, 64 gigabyte touchscreen music player. It would have been so exciting. And the fact that this is the best sounding one on the market would have sealed the deal for me. But now, you know, I can play music on my phone and it sounds great. And that's it. That's good enough.
And you know, I've got some training here because I went to school for audio engineering, and I can tell you just the amount of quality they packed into the Pono player is just ridiculous. It's beyond quality. It's beyond what your human ears can detect. Now, it's not to say that it doesn't even sound better than a phone, although David Pogue's single blind test appeared to say that people preferred their phones. Given the same quality audio file, let's say you're using FLAC or something like that, you know, it's not to say that a 64 kilobit MP3 is going to sound just as good as a lossless song on Pono. That's definitely not the case. And in fact, I would imagine that to a trained ear, the Pono would sound better than a phone because it's probably got a higher quality digital audio converter in it. So I would imagine that it sounds a little bit better. But I mean, compared to any other device out there, for most people, they're going to prefer what they're listening to. And if people are listening to and are used to how phones sound and the particular distortion that a phone gives to imbues upon the music, then they're going to end up preferring that just because that's what they're used to. So if somebody's used to records, it turns out if you do a test on them, they prefer records. If you have somebody who grew up playing cassettes, it turns out if you went back to the 90s and you tested people on cassette tapes, they'd probably prefer the cassette tapes to the CD. And so whatever people are used to is what they like. So that, I think that would explain people preferring a phone's audio over the Pono player. But even with that out of the way, and even with the Pono probably having a better quality digital audio converter, the amount of quality in the file is just totally ludicrous. You know, it's something that not even animals with better hearing than us could possibly even be able to tell a difference. You know, a dog wouldn't be able to tell a difference even though they have a larger capacity to hear lower and higher things than we have. It's just the amount of data that they've shoved into that file format is just completely beyond what any human could possibly ever hear. So I'm not saying that CD quality is the end of the conversation, and I'm certainly not saying that 128 kilobit MP3 is the end of the conversation, but having the Pono have such quality is totally ridiculous and completely unneeded.
Yeah, I agree with you, Chris. Wax cylinder, that's the end of the conversation. they sound the best. Wax cylinder and then mini disc, and everything else is below that.
So, Taylor, a little while ago, this was on January 12th, so nearly a month ago, I did a little bit of research, and I was comparing different animals to whether or not they could hear the difference between CD quality and a Pono. So the closest animal that I could find that was above the threshold of 44.1 kilohertz audio and the 192 kilohertz audio of the Pono player was a parakeet. So a parakeet is, in fact, an animal that can tell a difference between CD quality and the Pono player. And also worth noting that with hearing, with the hearing of a porpoise, you would want to encode music at 300 kilohertz. So, you know, we're not alone, but I really can't stress enough just how overblown the quality of the music is on the Pono player. There's just no way that anybody
for can humans and most animals, but not parakeets or porpoises.
Yeah.
Well, I think you just found the Pono player's target market, Chris.
Parakeets.
They should change their advertising strategy immediately.
Yeah. So I think we're seeing this borne out in a lot of the reviews we've been seeing. If you wanted to put a positive spin on it, it really does have quality audio, more so than a human could ever hear. So if you really want the best quality audio and you've got a $1,000 pair of earphones and that's really what you want, then
and a picky parakeet,
then it's maybe worth a look, because I'm not sure of any other device that even goes above CD quality in a way that would be able to be heard by humans. So it certainly achieves that goal.
Well, no one is doubting that it achieves that goal above and beyond. I mean, it's no question. You do need good headphones, and it's worth noting that the Pono player comes in a very handsome wooden box, which apparently is shipping to most stores in a very non-handsome cardboard box. And the set does not include cheap earbuds, because why would you want those?
No.
That's just offensive.
But anyway, I think for the end user, you would be better off spending $400 on a pair of earphones than you would on the Pono player. That's kind of the big takeaway that I've got. And you'd be better off just spending that money on a really good set of earphones, and you'd be way better off listening to phone audio, potentially FLAC, and listening to it on a phone with really good earphones. You'd probably have a better experience that way than listening on crappy earbuds on a high quality Pono.
Right. Unless you're trying to please a prodigal porpoise.
Yes.
Or a picky parakeet.
Or a parakeet, yes. I think that's the next version of Ubuntu.
I like prodigal porpoise a lot better.
Prodigal porpoise.
But I want neither making fun of my music selections.
Yeah, besides, they're up into the T's naming convention by now. So
you missed... Yeah, they're a little past parakeets and porpoises.
I think it was a panda or something. I forget what it was. All right, well, let's move away from that. I spent a little bit more time ranting on that than I had thought I would, but that was pretty good. Let's get into a new startup, which is pretty interesting. I had a little bit of trouble pronouncing this, but from what I heard in their promo video, it's Eero. So this is a device that is kind of a reimagining of what it means to be a Wi-Fi router. So they're attempting to make the Wi-Fi router setup and use as seamless as possible. So it's a device that is also a repeater. So you can buy like three of these things and put them around the house, and it will repeat the Wi-Fi signal and amplify the Wi-Fi signal, and so that you can cover a larger area. And you just buy three of them and throw them around the house. Now, that's one thing, and that's fine, and some people need that. But I think what's kind of cooler, in a sense, is that instead of, you know, navigating to 192.168.1.1 and then, you know, typing admin as the password or whatever, this thing, you pair it with Bluetooth with a smartphone, and you've got the admin interface on your smartphone via some kind of app. So the router's also self-updating, which I thought was pretty cool. And you can just make new Wi-Fi hotspots on the fly. And you just tell the app a new network name and give it a password, and it'll just do that. So it seems like it's a pretty decent device for just kind of the user experience of setting up Wi-Fi. But that said, I'm not sure I know anybody that... either didn't know how to do this already and, you know, don't mind the kind of complicated setup, or they know someone that would do it for them already.
Well, I definitely know people who have had trouble, enough trouble that they couldn't do it themselves. They didn't have anyone who knew how to set up a multiple Wi-Fi access point network,
Well, that's true.
and even if they do, they don't necessarily know how to do it. Now, the easiest router setup that I've seen to create an access point and a repeater is Apple. And actually, if you wanted an access point and two repeaters, if you got three Apple Airport Expresses, that's $300. And Eero's pre-order price, because they're not selling yet, is $300 for three. And it'll be more than that once it launches.
Yeah, so they're
So
hoping
it will
to
be like, it is easier than how Apple administers their airport devices right now. If a regular router is not good enough for you, and you also really don't want to pay someone to set up a multiple access point network for you, this could be a good option. But otherwise, there are good options already available for cheaper, albeit not by much, and they're not easier.
Right. Yeah. I think that's kind of the point is this is easier and it's really easier if you have a multi-router network set up in a larger house or something like that that needs it. So
Yeah, or you don't have a multi-router set up and you really need one.
I think what the company is thinking is that, when we stepped from the Palm Pilots and smartphones of old into iPhone and Android, then we had this increase in usability. And I think they're trying to go after the same thing, but for setting up Wi-Fi. And it's just, Wi-Fi is something you set up once. So I'm not sure they'll achieve it in that sense. But it does look like if they deliver what they say they've got, then they have indeed made that experience a lot better, albeit at a price. And especially with a multi-router setup, that is, looks to be a lot easier. And Taylor, I think the biggest thing that I can take away from this is that all routers should be self-updating from now on, just like Chrome does. If Chrome updates and I barely even notice, all routers should be the same thing because all these.
Well, we've seen routers introduce security holes through
Exactly.
software updates, and I think one of those was actually a self-update. So before routers get self-updating, they've got to be more secure.
Well, I think you're better to introduce a security hole via a self update than you are to permanently leave a security hole in because it's not self updating.
And what if it messes up your wireless access and you can't fix it because your wireless access is messed up?
Well, that's something they'd have to make it as seamless as things like Chrome do it, but it is certainly
They
possible.
would, but no one's done that yet. Eero appears to be the first one who's trying.
Yes, and well, that's one of the reasons why they're significant, I think. That's why people are looking into this and saying, yes, that's something that is interesting.
Okay, I also think it's interesting.
Yeah.
I can think of everything we've talked about on this show so far, this is one of the biggest target markets, I think. I know lots of people who would like having something like this.
Okay. So they're saying the pre-order is up right now for $125. They're hoping to hit the target of a retail price of $199 per unit. And there was some kind of discount if you bought like three of them or something. But
Well, it's three of them for 300.
okay, three of them for three. So that's
That's the
substantial.
pre-order price.
Yeah, so that's substantial then.
Yeah, because otherwise it'd be 500 or
Yeah.
more, depending on what target they hit.
Cool. Well, speaking of very expensive things, let's get into your Green Tech Story of the Week. What do you got for us this week?
Well, I'm talking about the Tesla Model S this week. So it is indeed a very expensive thing. It's probably one of the most powerful electric motors that has ever been available for consumers to buy, or that any consumer would have any good reason to buy if they weren't building an industrial plant. But Tesla's been selling very well. The Model S is a very successful vehicle, and that was apparently without its full power range on the accelerator. So because it uses a single gear electric motor in the car, it has a tremendous amount of torque that can be applied through all four wheels to the ground in order to accelerate the car quickly. But they weren't letting the cars go through software as fast as they were capable of going, or accelerating as quickly as they were capable of going right off the line. Now, Tesla has introduced a firmware update to any and every Model S called Insanity Mode. And so you can switch it on from your dashboard, and apparently the results are insane. They're quite fast because, by nature of its design, having a giant motor that can provide torque right from the beginning of its acceleration, the beginning of its power curve, it jumps forward a lot faster than any Ferrari or Lamborghini or, name your fast car. McLaren's a pretty fast car. Now, those supercars will still beat the Model S in certain tests. For one thing, the Model S is software limited still to 130 miles per hour, and those other cars can go a lot faster than that. But right at the beginning, right in the first half a second to a second, the Model S in Insanity Mode is very fast.
Also, you know what's
Now,
kind of crazy is that it says here that it can go, when it first starts accelerating, it's making about as less noise than a dishwasher, right? So that's also got to be a little startling.
yeah, it's probably more like riding a roller coaster than a car.
Right.
Now, it's worth pointing out that Insanity Mode on the Tesla is not particularly energy efficient. Your range will go way down, and you are going to have to juice up more often. But then, hey, it's still an electric car. It's still not too bad. You're not throwing hydrocarbons into the air every time you hit the accelerator.
Right, you just have to worry about where your power came from.
Well, that's something we all have to worry about.
Yeah, but I mean for the car. So instead of worrying about burning gasoline, you're worrying about where that power was generated and whether it was a coal plant or whatever.
I think most Tesla owners can just pat themselves on the back. They say, I've got the Tesla, I'm doing my job. Maybe some of them are powering their Tesla with solar power, and that's greatly admirable, but a single person can't completely control what power plants are operating at any given time.
Yeah.
So we've got the video in the show notes. You can check it out for a little bit of enjoyment, or if you happen to have a Tesla, go insane.
Yeah, turn on insanity mode and let us know how it goes. All right, Taylor, well, we've also got a tip of the week and an app pick of the week just before we round out the show. Well, what's our tip of the week? What's going on here? This is like a meta tip of the week. In fact, it's in some ways it's an anti tip of the week.
It is. So it is a video for Mental Floss, run by the popular video blogger John Green. Or is it Hank? Does Hank run Mental Floss? It's one of the Green brothers. Anyway, I think we've featured one of these videos before where they create a little highlight of popular life hacks and test them. So this is their third iteration of life hack tests, and they do about 30 of them. In under 10 minutes, and tell you which ones work and which ones don't. It's an entertaining video. It covers a lot of the type of life hacks that we don't normally feature on this show. So if you only get Life Hacker through our tip of the week and app pick, you are not going to recognize any of the ones on this, which means you won't have to remember the ones that don't work. It's an entertaining video. It's got a lot of tip of the week type stuff that we haven't covered before. So take 9 minutes. Enjoy it. Have fun. Learn some things.
And don't grate frozen butter. Just don't do it. It's not
I
going to
do
work.
not. No, that's never come up for me.
It's not just not going to work, Taylor. It's just not going to
That one sort of worked. It got a pass.
it. It got a pass on a technicality.
That's my favorite kind of pass, Chris.
It is kind of the best pass. It passes in the most ridiculous way possible. That's the best way to do
No, the Seahawks pass in the most ridiculous way possible.
it.
Zing! Yes! Super Bowl zing!
Oh, you got one in there. That's good. All right. Well, I'm going to have to fine you later for that kind of comment.
What, that was an excessive celebration. I ended it very quickly.
All right. Well, I've got a tip of the week, or sorry, an app pick of the week for us, and that is it came to light. In fact, we've known this for a long time that AdBlock Plus, in fact, has a whitelist built into it that companies can kind of buy their way into. So there was a story somewhere some time ago saying that this was the case, and it's been the case for a long time. We've actually known that that is the case for a long time, but there is in fact an alternative ad blocker, and it's called Microblock. It's open source. It's up on GitHub. So if you're a developer, you can go up there and have a look. But it's a Chrome and Firefox extension, and it's got to be Internet Explorer as well, but I'm not sure of that bit. But I've been using it for a little bit. It seems to work pretty well, and I think I'm going to stick with it. So its claim to fame is that its memory footprint and processor footprint is vastly lower than a lot of its competitors. So it seems like a decent little plugin, and you install it, and then hopefully for the sites that you actually like, you kind of put them in a whitelist. So, for example, if you want to put the Digital Media Zone in the whitelist, then you are knowing that we're making money off of the ads that get shown to people on the site. Although, not a lot. Banner ads don't generate a lot of cash, but this one seems like a pretty good extension, and I'm kind of glad to endorse it. So we've got a link to the Chrome store in the show notes, and there's also a Firefox version available, which I will bring into the show notes once after the show, once I pull that link in. So that's it. It's called Microblock, and it's an alternative ad blocker.
Yeah, I really like this one. I love the idea of their focus on efficiency in terms of system resources. It's actually one of the reasons why I don't often use AdBlock. I like my browsers to run lean, and this one claims to actually reduce memory and CPU use overall once you add it, because it's able to cut down so much just from blocking the ads.
Yeah, so the two standard privacy things that you would typically use is an ad blocker and Ghostery. And Ghostery blocks like Google Analytics and that kind of thing. So if you're going to some, fly-by-night website and you don't want to see their ads and you don't want them to see you in Google Analytics and that kind of thing, then those are two pretty good ones. And Microblock is my new favorite one, like we've been saying. And again, it really, your eyeballs pay for content. So you should add sites that you actually like to the whitelist, just so that you don't block all of that. But yeah, if you're just kind of following a link somewhere and you don't really know where it's going, and then it can be good to kind of block a lot of this stuff.
Cool, yeah, it's nice. Well, I just added Microblock, or MuBlock, as I might call
yes.
it. I'm not sure how they would say it.
I'm pretty sure it's micro, because mu is the symbol for micro, and it's supposed to be a smaller benchmark, right? So I think that's their motivation, but it could be MuBlock. I'm not sure.
Right, but it's not spelled microblock. It's spelled with the Greek character mu.
Right. All right, Taylor, well, let's get out of the app pick, and let's get into our kicker, and this is a pretty fun one. As you know, I've seen drones, like, everywhere recently for whatever reason. They've been on the news. They're in the general consciousness of humans now, it seems, and we've got a particularly fun one to share with everyone, and that is somebody modded one of his drones to look like a Millennium Falcon. So
well, there's only one Millennium Falcon, Chris. Come on.
But is like a plastic shell around the four rotors, and he's even got an illuminated strip on the back to indicate the hyperspace engine back there. So there's a video in the post we're sharing. It looks pretty cool. It looks like a very well done kind of DIY project for this person who put this together. It seems really, really cool. It looks pretty professional.
Yeah, it looks great, and it must have taken a lot of work to get it to fly correctly and not weigh too much.
Yeah.
But it's a really impressive little one-off design here, and well, that's why we shared it. It's the Millennium Falcon. It's a model Millennium Falcon.
Right, and I don't think it's as fast as the real Millennium Falcon.
Right. Well, ironically, being dressed as the Millennium Falcon slows it down by 66%.
Yeah, true. So it would be better actually not being dressed up. But it's pretty darn cool anyway.
Just a naked drone is faster, but that's in atmospheric conditions, and the Millennium Falcon is faster in hyperspace.
Yeah, I would imagine it's faster in hyperspace, which is not a real thing. I'd imagine when you invent a physical paradigm, then you can go as fast as you want, really.
But the Millennium Falcon can go faster.
Right, at least than this drone. All right, well, I think it's time to get out of here, Taylor. If somebody were to try to contact you, perhaps via drone, how would they go about doing this?
If they can contact me via drone, there's nothing that I can say to stop them, but I'm certainly not going to encourage it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they'd have to have your address, so they'd have to dig that up somehow. But I don't know, maybe Twitter's
I
better.
don't have an address. Now
Oh, that's
you
right, you're in
can't
the
read
future.
my address because it's in the future. No. Wouldn't it be just easier if they could contact me on Twitter? Would that be okay, do you think?
Yeah, that's probably fine.
Okay, here's my Twitter address. It's at TaylorPhone.
Yeah, and I am at Chris Hale Barnes if you wanted to get at me for some reason. And together, if you want to just talk about the show or whatever, we've got at the end user, THENDUSR as well. So you can give us a follow over there as well. So that'll do it for this week. So thank you everyone for listening to the show. And of course, you can find more information, including the show notes over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0 and Home On. You can also send us some feedback. We've got the end user at thedigitalmediazone.com, and like I mentioned, we are at the end user. You can join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye. Taylor, that drone made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs.
Well, it was just a foam model of the Kessel Run.